In the last presidential election, 57% of voters were white Christians. But as demographics diversify in America, projections suggest that the voting electorate will change accordingly. Our guest will explain why he says white Christian America will no longer exist and what that means for the future of American politics. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest is the author of The End of White Christian America, and we'll welcome your questions and thoughts for him. Do you think that white Christian America is dead, or do you think it's alive and well? How have you seen politics and race change in America? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Robert P. Jones, a leading scholar and commentator on religion, culture, and politics. He is the CEO of Public Religion Research Institute. He regularly contributes to a column for The Atlantic and appears on segments on Interfaith Voices. His most recent book is The End of White Christian America, and he joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for having me.
What does it mean when you say white Christian America is ending?
Yeah. Well, it's important that I'm not making a claim about white Christians ending. Obviously, that's not what's happening. But when the term white Christian America, I define in the book really as a metaphor for this kind of cultural and political world that was built primarily by white Protestants that really did hold kind of the center, the cultural center of the country. It set the tone for our national conversations and really shaped American ideals. It was really the central cultural hub. And so the book is really about the kind of passing from the scene of that kind of cultural dominance of this white Protestant world.
So to talk a little bit more about the demographics of religion in America.
Yeah. Well, you know, we really are experiencing, particularly over the last decade or so, an unprecedented change in the religious landscape. We had seeds of this, you know, a few decades ago, but just the last decade has been quite remarkable. So just to kind of make this concrete, if we go back just two election cycles to 2008, when President Barack Obama was first running for office, the country was 54% white and Christian, so still a solid majority white Christian country. That number, and our latest numbers from 2015, is 45%. So just during the last two election cycles, we've gone from being a majority white Christian nation to a minority white Christian nation. And while, you know, I think people may not know these numbers, and then one of the reasons I wrote the book is because we had passed this tremendous threshold, and yet there hadn't really been a lot of attention to it. But I do think that people are feeling this shift in their bones, and it is animating a lot of our politics today.
How are we feeling that shift in our bones?
You know, I think it's you know, many people feel it just, you know, in their everyday, you know, you walk down the street, you know, and you see signs in Spanish. You see, you know, churches that were once thriving in neighborhoods and now have been turned into loft apartments or restaurants. You see the waning of the kind of major institutions such as the National Council of Churches, which was once a very powerful expression of Protestant power in the country and, you know, now really doesn't wield a lot of influence. So, you know, I think people see it on the local level and you can see it in kind of institutional expressions at the national level. I mean, our first African-American president is a very big symbol. Perhaps one more that's also quite remarkable is that, you know, for most of the country, our Supreme Court justices have been white and Protestant. In fact, 91 of the 112 justices who have ever sat on the bench were Protestant, and 90 of those 91 were white. Today, we have exactly zero Protestants on the Supreme Court. And if Merrick Garland gets confirmed, we would have five Catholic justices and four Jews. That's quite new in the country.
So who specifically is part of white Christian America?
Yeah. Well, you know, when I talk about the white Christian America as a metaphor and the Protestant world that really the white Protestant world that built that, there really are two groups of people that primarily I'm talking about there. There is you kind of think of these as two branches of the white Protestant family tree. And one on one side, you have the more kind of liberal end that's concentrated up in the Northeast, the mainline Protestant world. These are Episcopalians, Presbyterians, United Methodists. I mean, that group of denominations, they're dominated in the Northeast and also the upper Midwest as well. So places like Wisconsin and Minnesota, lots of Lutherans there. That's part of that world. And then more in the sort of lower Midwest in the South, you have the more conservative branch of the family tree. Those are white evangelical Protestants.
Yeah. And so who's, I guess, who's now gaining when it comes to the demographics of race and religion?
Yeah. Well, the thing that sort of struck me is that we've had kind of some external factors and some internal factors that have really driven this change. The external factors are immigration patterns, that since the U.S. opened up its immigration policy in the mid-1960s, we've had an influx of a lot of non-European, particularly from Mexico and Latin America immigrants that have been changing the overall demographics of the country. The other sort of external factor or demographic factor is just differential birth rates, that white Christian Americans have been having fewer children than non-white Christian Americans and non-whites in general. That has also meant the kind of graying of this world as their average age is getting older. But there's been one big internal factor that has really accelerated this trend, and that is the disaffiliation of large numbers of people from white Christian churches. So in the early 1990s, only 1 in 10 Americans, or less than 1 in 10 actually, Americans claim no religious affiliation whatsoever. Our latest numbers on that are 23% of the American public now claims no religious affiliation. And if you look at younger people, that number is 34% of those under the age of 30. And most of those have really come from the ranks of white Christian America.
Interesting. So the nuns are growing.
That's right. The nuns, the N-O-N-E-S's, right? Yeah. They're religiously unaffiliated. They've basically, they've nearly tripled, really, since the 1990s.
Yeah. So, well, let me just share. Brandy on Facebook says, I see white Christian America in full force and louder than ever in terms of, I guess, Donald Trump supporters. So what about that?
Yeah, well, loud is right, I think, with Donald Trump, Trump supporters. But here's the thing. I mean, you know, Trump presents a little bit of a conundrum. And I should say that this book was written and the text was locked and off to production just at the moment that Trump was announcing his presidency. So I don't address Trump at all in the book. But I do think the book nonetheless casts a lot of light on the Trump phenomenon. I actually wrote about this in The Atlantic in February and then about a few weeks ago in The New York Times. But what I think has happened with Trump is that he has essentially converted these self-described values voters, which is the way that I think many evangelicals presented themselves and were talked about in the media. He's converted values voters into what I've been calling nostalgia voters. And what I mean by that is this, that Trump's appeal to them has never been, I'm one of you, I share your views on abortion, I share your views on same-sex marriage. He's never really played the traditional Christian right playbook. But what he's done instead is he's kind of used the slogan, let's make America great again. And that last word, again, I think, has been doing an enormous amount of work with white evangelical Protestants. And what's going on there is there was a speech he gave to an evangelical college early in the primaries that I think went by without a lot of attention. But I think it's really key that he was speaking to a group of evangelicals and he said, I'm going to restore power to the Christian churches if I'm elected. If I'm elected, we're going to be saying Merry Christmas again in this country and not Happy Holidays. And I think he's addressing this kind of loss of cultural power that I think many white evangelicals feel as the country now has legalized same-sex marriage, is increasingly pluralistic in terms of religion and in terms of race. Maybe one just number here that I think puts this a fine point on this, that when we asked Americans whether they think the country is changing for the better or changing for the worse since the 1950s, Americans as a whole are evenly divided on this question. However, when we ask white evangelical Protestants, 7 in 10 say that the country has changed for the worse since the 1950s. So when Donald Trump says, let's make America great again, I think many white evangelicals hear in this a call back to a time when their values and their institutions had a lot more power and influence in society than they do today.
So how do you predict the shrinking Christian voter pool, white Christian voter pool, is going to affect the 2016 election?
Well, I argue in the book that Mitt Romney's campaign was actually the last one where what I call a white Christian strategy was going to be successful. That is, this tactic of trying to pile up super majorities of white Christian voters to compensate for the growing numbers of kind of more diverse Latinos, the religiously unaffiliated, and other groups that are growing in the country. But this is really a strategy that is trying to maximize a shrinking voter pool. Now, the Republican Party actually recognized this after Romney's defeat and actually put out this thing that kind of that got dubbed the autopsy report in 2013, where they called for a big tent Republican party that de-emphasized gay marriage, opposition to gay marriage, that supported comprehensive immigration reform and a path to citizenship for immigrants who are in the country illegally. Now, this sounds nothing like the Trump campaign. So I think we may actually have a test case on our hand of whether or not I was right in the book that Mitt Romney's campaign was going to be the last one that could plausibly win with this strategy, because Trump seems to have thrown out the Republican Party's own recommendations and really doubled down on this white Christian strategy.
We are talking with Robert Jones. He is the author of The End of White Christian America. And we are talking about why he says white Christian America is ending and what that's going to mean for politics and for our country. And we welcome your questions and your thoughts at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. What are your hopes or fears with the end of white Christian America? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about the changing demographics of race and religion and politics with Robert Jones, who is the CEO of Public Religion Research Institute and author of the new book, The End of White Christian America. What will this mean for this country, for the election, for politics in general? Do you think that white Christian America is dead? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let's go to the phones. Jim in Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Jim.
Hey, good morning. This is a great topic. I've called in before, and I'm trying to, on the same issues. When you look at it, for the last 7 or 8 years, we've had this onslaught of attacks about this thing called God, where you had, you know, the religion, when you had President Obama saying people cling to their guns and religion, and Nancy Pelosi saying, you know, because of whites vote Republican because of guns, gays, and God being the woman's right to choose. And then you also had Hillary Clinton saying you have to change your cultural codes and religious beliefs. So these are people that claim to be, you know, at one point they seem to be God-fearing people or religious people or not attacking Christians, but you can see that's their focus.
Yeah, that's, so the Democrats,
when you pigeonhole somebody and say God being the women's right to choose, does that say, well, if you believe in God, you can't be for women's right to choose?
Yeah, but you're saying, Jim, that you think Democrats use these issues.
Seems obvious, yeah. Because they never talk about what other religions might be against gay marriage or anything else. Yeah. It seems to be Christians.
Do Democrats, what's your reaction to that, Robert Jones? Are Democrats anti-religion?
I think, you know, what the caller is identifying is, you know, if I had been listening to this in 2008 or 2004, especially when the kind of whole values voters movement was in play, where Republicans were really branding themselves as the party of evangelical Christianity and the expression of those values, you know, it sounds like a throwback a little bit to me. I mean, in this race, we have, you know, on the one hand, someone who grew up United Methodist, went to, you know, United Methodist churches her whole life, and has talked about her. She doesn't do it on the campaign trail a lot, but, you know, if you look, you can see places where she's talked about the effect of her faith on her public life as well. And then on the other hand, you have a candidate who's head of the Republican Party who has said he's never asked for forgiveness for anything. That's a fundamental tenet, particularly of evangelical Christianity, that you can't be saved if you haven't asked for forgiveness. That he is very unfamiliar with church culture. He talked about 2 Corinthians instead of 2 Corinthians. He tried to put money in the communion plate at a church in Iowa. So he's a candidate who is, you know, all the gaffes on religion have happened here. And I think that is one of the real puzzles of the election that, you know, traditionally, yes, we've seen this, that evangelical Christians particularly have seen the Democratic Party as hostile, but along the lines of these issues, abortion, same-sex marriage, these are issues Donald Trump really isn't talking about that much. And he also has this kind of very awkward relationship with Christianity. So I think we're actually seeing this script being challenged a little bit, that, you know, it's no longer that easy to say, oh, the Republican Party is the party of, you know, Christianity and Democrats are hostile to religion. That's just not the way that it looks with the candidates at the top of the ticket.
Yeah, we've had callers saying that they couldn't understand why a conservative voters would vote for Donald Trump because of his multiple marriages and other things.
Yeah. You know, well, I do think it goes back to this real sense of loss and this sense of nostalgia for this. You know, the other thing that I think are animating white evangelical voters is a kind of anxiety about cultural and racial change. I mean, the other thing to say that the caller mentioned here is that, you know, in this same time period, 2008 to 2016, we've also gone from a country where only 4 in 10 supported same-sex marriage to today 53% support same-sex marriage, and the Supreme Court has ruled that same-sex marriage is legal in all 50 states. That's a huge cultural sea change in a short amount of time, and I think that sense of kind of vertigo and cultural shift, and you combine that with the demographic changes, you know, just one more number here that, you know, among white evangelicals, nearly 2/3 say it bothers them when they come into contact with immigrants who speak little English. And more than 2/3 now also believe that discrimination against whites has become as big a problem as discrimination against blacks and other minorities. So this deep sense of kind of racial conflict combined with this kind of cultural shift on these kind of symbolic issues like same-sex marriage, I think are driving this sense of nostalgia, anxiety. And when Trump says, we're going to make America great again, I'm going to restore power to the Christian churches, it is this sense that he is going to turn back the clock to a country that seems more recognizable to many of these voters.
Did you say that Donald Trump tried to put money in a communion cup?
He did, in a church in Iowa. Yeah, when the plate was passed and it had communion wafers in it, he mistook it for the offering plate.
I see. So how did religion and politics become so closely intertwined in America?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it's always been the case that we've had separation of church and state, but we really haven't had separation of religion and politics. And I think that's been true really since the country's founding. But, you know, what I think is new is that we have historically been able to, yeah, we've had diversity, we've had other groups in the country, but we've had this kind of dominant cultural center of kind of white Protestants, that E.J. Dionne, right at the Washington Post, has called America's civic glue, is one way he put it. And I think what's really different today is that that group is no longer big enough, are powerful enough to really hold that center and be the kind of hub around which everything else revolves. And so we're at a new place where it's really unclear, I think. And this is why I think some of the anxieties are out there in the culture the way they are. It's unclear what's going to hold, you know, whether the center is going to hold, and if so, how, given that this thing that has held it together in the center is really now passing from the scene.
You touched on it, but in your book, you frame the conversation around death, starting the book with an obituary and ending with a eulogy. And you talk about the different stages of grief. Why did you choose to frame the topic in this way?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think we're also at a place where this shift has happened. I think Americans are just beginning to really wrap their heads around what it means, you know, for politics, for culture, for churches, for civic institutions. So we're kind of struggling with what it means. There's a kind of vacuum, I think, there that people are trying to figure out what to do with it. So, you know, I wanted to kind of start off with a very clear, you know, it's a little tongue in cheek, but it's, you know, a serious attempt to say that this cultural power is no longer with us. So that's why I start with the obituary. And then at the end, it's also clear to me that, you know, we have people reacting to this death in a number of different ways. So I tried to imagine myself, you know, at funerals, which you and maybe many of your callers have been at, or your listeners have been at, you know, this maybe like a complicated funeral where there are some people among family and friends that for the deceased was a beloved, you know, person. They're very upset and sad about and grieving. And then for some other people, maybe this person had like an abusive relationship with, and they're, you know, more than ready to say good riddance. You know, and so I kind of imagine myself trying to address, you know, this very complicated story. And I think there are many Americans that way. I think one of the things of the rise of the unaffiliated has been a real rejection of traditional forms of religiosity in the country. And many of those people are ready to say good riddance to this kind of cultural presence in the country. And, you know, but then there are many more, nearly half the country that belongs to that world of white Christian America, who are apt to feel some combination of anger, denial, depression, and grief about its shift, and are really struggling to figure out where their place is in the new America.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Robert Jones, author of The End of White Christian America. We're talking about why he says white Christian America is ending and what that's going to mean for politics and policy and the country in general. What do you think? What questions do you have? Are you seeing this end of white Christian America? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Are you frightened by this end of white Christian America, or do you welcome it? In part, this is because the pool of white Christian voters is shrinking. White Christian voters are becoming the minority, and we're talking about why that is and what it means for politics and policy. Here's a listener on Facebook says. It's Huria on Facebook who says, the end of Christian America? Well, that's okay. It was the end of Native America when it was colonized by savages. I think he means by whites. The fact that it has become diverse with people of various races and cultures makes it beautiful. I can't wait until it's all mixed up and we learn to respect those of different backgrounds, which leads to cultural competence. You want to react to that, Robert Jones?
Mm. Well, that phrase, it's beautiful, reminds me, I write about this in the book, of a Coca-Cola commercial that came out in the Super Bowl, I believe it was 2012, and it was a depiction of, it was like a 2-minute commercial, but it was a depiction of Americans. To the soundtrack, America the Beautiful, and it was a depiction of all kinds of Americans. There were, you know, your typical kind of Caucasian American. There were people dressed in, you know, Western garb. There was also people who looked like recent immigrants. There were Latino people, Asian Pacific Islanders, Native Americans. And then there were also kind of different kinds of relationships depicted, you know, straight couples, couples, gay couples, all in this kind of montage of, you know, and the title of the thing was America, It's Beautiful. And this actually caused quite a firestorm of protest of among many conservative and particularly conservative white Christians in the country who really objected to this depiction of America with this song that they associate, you know, really with American patriotism, because it didn't really look like the country that they picture in their minds when they sing this song. And I think it's a real it was a telling moment or a window into the kind of moment that we're really in the country today.
So what does the end mean for members of white Christian America?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it means a couple of things. Like, one is, I think, a whole set of assumptions that have been able that kind of white, particularly white Protestants have been able to run with are really, you can't just assume them anymore. Like, you can't make big sweeping statements like we are the moral majority. Right. That was, you know, if you think about that as the rallying cry of the conservative Christian movement in the 1980s. There was a kernel of truth to that. I mean, they were against gay rights, but so was the rest of the country. And there was a way in which they could claim to be the moral majority. And I think that one kind of realization is that those kinds of claims just simply can't be made anymore. So the kind of engagement, rather than saying we are the majority and, you know, we're going to sort of get out ahead of the parade and everybody should fall into line, that's not really going to be possible. What I think it's going to mean for public engagement is realizing that they are that group, you know, represents one perspective or a couple of perspectives. It's a pretty diverse group, and that it has to kind of think about coalition politics rather than kind of unilateral public engagement in the way that it has done in the past. I also think the kind of great numbers of young people exiting Christian churches is going to have, there's going to have to be a little bit of a soul searching, I think, among Christian clergy, seminaries, and leadership and denominational leadership to, you know, ask what that means and what it is that younger people are responding to in traditional Christianity, particular traditional white Protestant churches.
Let's go to Tammy in Milwaukee next. Hello, Tammy.
Hi. I love this conversation. I think it's so relevant to what's going on today. I just wanted to say, I wonder how much he thinks this really has to do with race as opposed to religion. I mean, in so many ways, you know, Jesus was a social justice warrior, which is a lot of the things that Democrats talk about with their social programs and things like that. And it just seems like, I know I personally am so surprised to see some of my own friends and family members who are very conservative Christian embracing Donald Trump in the way that they have. I just think it seems at the end, you know, it really comes down to more a loss of white privilege in a way than it really does about religion. And I just wondered what his take mm-hmm. was on that.
Robert Jones?
Well, I think insightful. You know, I think the I'm my background is in sociology, and the tricky thing is trying to tease out, you know, the independent influence of these things. And the truth is they're all wrapped up together. I mean, that was one thing, the real insights is that, you know, what defined, you know, white Protestant America often was things it was defining itself against. It was defining itself against sort of communism in the mid-1950s. It was also defining itself against Catholicism, interestingly enough, was kind of one of the shaping things. But it was also, and in the South in particular, and in some parts of the Midwest, it was defining itself in response to racial politics as well. And so I think, and kind of responses to the civil rights movement in particular. And so I think that history is like really important to remember that it's about race. It's about kind of culture and region. It is all wrapped up together. But one of the things I think will happen, or that I'm at least hopeful that will happen, is that as a lot of these assumptions fall by the wayside and they have to be then interrogated and questioned, I think there's a moment here, there's an opening for kind of self-reflection to kind of rethink what does it mean to be church? What does it mean to be Christian? What does it mean to be white? You know, that are harder questions to ask when you're the majority, but they become questions that become on the table once a group kind of moves from being this kind of assumed majority to being just one of many other groups active in society.
I'm wondering if some of the Christian religious voters who are supporting Donald Trump are supporting him in part because of, and I know you didn't write this book with Donald Trump's candidacy in mind, but he has talked about the temporary ban on Muslims coming into this country. He talks about building the wall between Mexico and the U.S. Is that how he is appealing to white Christian America?
I do think that's part of it. I mean, I think the sense of the country changing in ways that many, particularly evangelical Protestants, find alarming. I mean, it's worth noting that, he beat Ted Cruz all across the South among white evangelical voters. So in places like South Carolina and Mississippi, the GOP primaries were made up of voters who were 7 in 10 white evangelical Protestant in many of those states. And they should have been states really, at least on paper, that Ted Cruz should have easily won. With his own kind of Southern Baptist background, his father's a Baptist preacher, he himself can kind of speak that language and is very familiar. He's very unlikely to commit any of the gaffes that Trump has made. But Trump handily beat him. And I do think it's addressing the sense of anxiety and cultural change. And the difference was, I think that Cruz was trying, essentially what Cruz was doing was he was making an argument that he was going to defend the right of evangelicals and other conservatives to find like exemptions to these cultural changes, or to carve out little areas where they could still kind of hold on to their cultural world, even while the rest of the country was changing around them. Donald Trump was saying, no, I'm not going to give you exemptions to these new realities. I'm going to change these realities back to the way that they were. I'm going to turn back the clock. I think that was really the strong appeal to evangelicals. And I guess one other thing I would add is it's also a kind of very real politic element here. An evangelical pastor named Robert Jeffries, who is the pastor of First Baptist Church in Dallas, Texas, probably put it most bluntly. And he just said, look, I'm not supporting Trump because he's one of us or because he's an evangelical Christian himself. But things have gotten so bad in this country. We're at such a crisis point that when I think about who I want in the Oval Office, I want the meanest son of a you-know-what I can find to defend our values. And that's Donald Trump.
Let's go next to Sheree in Waupun. Hi, Sheree.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much. I love the topic this morning. For me, you have to understand, I come from the South, and my dad was a Baptist minister for 35 years, and at the same church for 29 years. I had the privilege to see the inner workings of the church, which, to me, I think that turned me away, actually, from religion. It was interesting because, to me, I see inconsistent teachings, policies, and practices going on. I don't see compassion. And I think for a lot of people that I talk to, it seems to us like the teaching is backward from the practice. There is no compassion. You know, it seems to glorify money. It turns into you're successful and God will bless you if you do it this way, and they only consider you blessed if you're successful or rich. You know, it just seems so man-made. Yeah. That I just can't embrace it.
Sounds like Sheree's a part of those nuns, Robert Jones.
Yeah, I don't know how old she is, but it does sound like a lot of the things we hear from younger Americans, when we've asked, like, particularly young Americans who were raised religious and have now left organized religion, when we've asked them, and we certainly hear things about belief, particularly around like science and evolution, for those who came from churches that were dug in against those things, and certainly not all churches are, but for those who were, that was a stumbling point. The other thing that we heard, both in focus groups and in national surveys, about a third of younger people who were raised religious and now left and had left by their 20s said that anti-gay teachings and treatment of gay people, negative treatment of gay people, was an important part of their leaving the church. And I guess the third thing we've heard is the church being too wrapped up in partisan politics, that was a real turnoff for the millennial generation, kind of getting away from its religious mission and being wrapped up not just in politics per se, but in a kind of partisan form of politics that I think many of them found distasteful.
You know, Sheree mentioned that her father was a Baptist preacher in the South, an African-American Baptist preacher, and I'm trying to get my hands around this. What is the difference between right there? We have, I guess that's Black Christian rather than White Christian, right?
That's correct. So if that's right, it's interesting to hear. You know, if you look at African American Protestants in the country over this time, where white Protestants have been losing a lot of members, and white Catholics as well. African-American Protestant churches have actually basically maintained their market share. About 1 in 10 Americans today are African-American Protestants. That's been roughly true over the last few decades. So they actually haven't seen the kind of exodus among young people that the white, at least not at the scale that white churches have. So it's interesting to hear that that perspective from her.
Yeah, and politically, are Black Christians more likely to be Democratic voters, and white Christian voters are more likely to be Republican voters?
Yeah, absolutely. And what's interesting about this is that the patterns that we have seen over time in terms of voting patterns, and I think this is also something that, you know, it's not a healthy thing, in my opinion, for democracy, for there to basically what has happened over time is that the Republican Party, really starting in with Reagan, has increasingly become the party of white Christian voters. So there was a kind of big switch among, you know, before Reagan, many Christian voters in the South were Democrats, and it was really Reagan's presidency where they switched. Like, political scientists actually call this the Great White Switch that happened in the 1980s. And so what we basically see is, you know, white. This, if you were to kind of think about the religious landscape, you could kind of accurately say that white Christian groups, whether you're talking about white Catholics, white mainline Protestants, white evangelical Protestants, lean Republican. White evangelicals, for example, vote nearly 8 in 10 vote for Republican presidential candidates over the last few election cycles. And on the other side, the Democratic Party has this kind of coalition of non-white Christians, African-American Protestants, Latino Protestants, Latino Catholics, and the religiously unaffiliated and non-Christian religious groups, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, all leaning toward the Democratic Party. So we have this kind of race and religious divide in the electorate that's really, and that gap is getting larger. And we may see it actually as large as ever been over time. One quick thing to tie to the previous caller, too, is that that it's actually worth noting that, you know, you can't really it's never been true that the most religious groups in the country, the most religious Americans in the country have supported Republican candidates. African-Americans attend religious services at rates comparable, even a little higher to white evangelical Protestants. But they vote about 9 in 10 for Democratic presidential candidates.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Robert Jones. He is the CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute, and he is the author of The End of White Christian America, Changing Demographics and a Shrinking White Christian Voter Pool is really mixing things up in America, talking about what this means for politics and our country, and welcoming your thoughts and questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about changing demographics in this country, in our politics, and what that means. Our guest is Robert Jones, CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute and author of the new book, The End of White Christian America. So are you concerned about this? Are you hopeful because of this? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Kevin in Crandon is with us. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, yes. What is the white atheist America viewpoint, if that's okay. I being up here in the Northwoods of Wisconsin, I can tell you that white Christian America is alive and well up here, and to be an atheist in this environment is something you don't want to publicize too much, because they're not going to like it. And I just get, there's too much religion in America, way, way, way too much. You know, every time something happens, the shootings and such, you know, oh, we all got to light a candle and pray and blah, blah, blah. And that's, I just get really tired of it.
Well, Kevin, thank you for sharing. An atheist in Wisconsin's Northwoods who says he doesn't see the end of white Christian America there, Robert Jones.
Yeah, well, from someone who is an atheist, it doesn't surprise me. He maybe sees the continuing power. And, you know, again, I want to be clear. In the book, I'm not sort of saying that, you know, white Christian churches are going to disappear or white Christians are going to disappear. It really is about the kind of hegemonic or dominant power that this cultural force has been in the country that I'm really talking about. And there's certainly lags, I think, in different parts of the country. So, for example, you know, I started with saying that, you know, we're now at a place where if you take all white Christians in the country, added up all together, it's only 45% of the country, so we're a minority white Christian country. But in places like Wisconsin is still 60% white and Christian, right? Because of the demographic differences there. So there are places, I think, where you know, it certainly is more alive and well, even as a cultural power, than it is on the national scene. One thing I'll say about atheists, though, is that I do think people like the recent caller, atheists in the country are really finding their voice, I think, in a way that has been, you know, maybe too taboo to do in the past. And while we still see in surveys that there is a lot of negative or feelings toward atheists. When you ask, would you vote for a candidate, for example, for your party, who is and give them a bunch of attributes? Being atheist or being Muslim are still two attributes that where less than a majority of people say they would vote for the person. Being Jewish, being Catholic, being evangelical, all kinds of other attributes, or being a woman, are no longer kind of disqualifiers for most Americans, but being atheist or Muslim are still things that give people pause. So there is still that attitude out there, but there are increasing numbers. So even as we've, you know, now nearly a quarter of Americans claim no religious affiliation, and inside that group, it's about a third of that group that is either atheist or agnostic. So, you know, that's now getting to be a significant number of Americans in the country. And I think increasingly we're getting people who maybe have been harbored those feelings privately, but never been willing to say them publicly, or more now willing to be, if you know, kind of borrow the term from the gay rights world, willing to be out as an atheist today.
David in Baruch was with us. Hello, David.
Hi. I think a lot of the political power that he is talking about that they're losing is coming about a simple unwillingness for those groups to release their prejudices, both against people of color and of other religions. And while he's chosen his words really carefully, I think where it really shone through was he was referring to what I think was a Coca-Cola ad, where he referred to the people as a typical Caucasian American. Well, the typical American is not necessarily Caucasian, and I think that's the attitude that this is coming from.
I don't know. Robert Jones, you want to respond to that?
I'm not sure I remember saying that. If I did, it certainly was. I didn't mean it in the way the caller is taking it. So, you know, I think I was following most of what he said up to that point, and you know, largely I think agree with what he was saying. But, you know, again, I think the bigger point here, I think, back to that It's Beautiful ad, is that people had very different reactions to that. And so, you know, in the book, I have very specific references to, you know, conservative kind of white Christian congressperson that tweeted out, you know, a reaction to it, and others who blogged about it very specifically, you know, just saying, this is not the America that I know. This is not the America that I think we ought to be celebrating. While others were saying, oh, yeah, you know, this is an amazing ad. Thank you, Coca-Cola. But I think the different reactions that we saw to that ad, you know, are a testimony to the fact that I think there is a real struggle, I think, in the country to know know what to do with these changing demographics, and some are celebrating it, some are lamenting it. But I think, you know, the important thing to note is that there's no indication these are going to be rolled back or stopped. So the real question is, how do we move forward, I think, as a country where we have a story to tell about what it means to be American and what America means, that can both be inclusive of the kind of new demographics and the new realities that we see, but also has a place for those white Christians who really were, who really did hold the center of the country for so long.
So, Robert Jones, are you lamenting or celebrating this change?
You know, I'm really neither. I mean, I'm trying the best in the book to really describe this reality, and I think that's why I use this frame as a eulogy at the end of the book, where I try to kind of honor both of these reactions to it. I mean, if I have a kind of point in the book, it is this that these changes, it's not just that they're happening, they have already happened. You know, we have already moved from this place of being a majority white Christian country to a minority white Christian country. And the question is, where do we go from here?
Yeah, so you say that where we might go from here is that the end of white Christian America could revitalize American politics. How so?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that we already had some hints of this. I mean, we are not seeing it play out, I think, in this election cycle, because Donald Trump has really, you know, thrown out the recommendations of his own party on this front. But, you know, I think that's going to be a limited strategy. I think, you know, that it's a little bit of an anomaly. And I think if we look back in the long term, what we will see is the Republican Party reaching out and being a bigger tent party. And I think it's that, I'm never sort of one who thinks altruism is, the driver of change, but self-interest is the driver of change. And I think we are at a place where no political party is going to be able to survive as a national party appealing to one demographic group. And I think it's that self-interest on the part of both Democrats and Republicans that are ultimately going to break down, you know, what began as the Southern strategy that then became the kind of white Christian strategy, particularly on the Republican side of politics. You know, we've had 10 years now of the chairs of the RNC apologizing for this Southern strategy and then putting out this report calling for a bigger tent Republicanism. And I think that's the way they're going to actually compete with Democrats, nationally in a stronger way.
And how you say that this also could finally desegregate churches?
You know, I'm less optimistic about this. I think there's a potential here, as well, of kind of rethinking. I mean, you know, when Martin Luther King said that 11 a.m. on Sunday morning is the most segregated hour in the country, that is still largely true today. About 8 in 10 congregations are essentially monoracial congregations. So there hasn't been a lot of progress on that front. There are some new models out there, and I think people are, even if they're sort of retaining their own churches, some kind of ways of cooperating, pulpit swaps, joint events between African-American Protestant congregations and, you know, other white denominations that are right down the road. I think these things are beginning to happen, but I think increasingly, again, I think because it's going to be necessary that white Protestant churches just aren't going to have the power, even down at the local level. They're going to need partners. They're going to need coalition partners. And I think that's by necessity going to break down some of these barriers.
I don't know if we have time, but we'll try. Duke in Milwaukee. Hi, Duke.
Hi. The folklore for churches is biblical. And the folklore for modern-day thinking is technological and scientific. Now, does that affect the youngsters coming into the church?
All right. So I think is science playing a role here, Robert Jones?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it depends on the church. I mean, because I think the more like mainline Protestant churches, I think, have done a better job of incorporating ways of thinking theologically about evolution, those kinds of things, more than evangelical churches have, many of whom have dug in on this. And I think it is the opposition there that has certainly caused many young evangelicals to rethink their connections.
Yeah. So in our final minute, where do we go from here?
Well, again, I think I would say that the biggest challenge before us is trying to figure out how do we come up with a conception of what it means to be American that is inclusive of both the old dominant groups and the new realities that we have ahead of us.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Robert Jones, author of The End of White Christian America. He is a scholar on and commentator on religion, culture, and politics, and the CEO of Public Religion Research Institute. Joining us today from NPR's studios in Washington, D.C. Thank you to producers Kai Brito, Brianne Shasso, and Bill Martins. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. Tomorrow at this time, it's The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.